Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Last time I talked about personal transformation. This topic, personal transformation, is central to Islamic mysticism. For those of you who were present in my last sermon, if you recall, I tied personal transformation to the concept of fitr. Fitr is the climax of Ramadan. That's the ending part of Ramadan. Fitr literally means to grow, to blossom. Personal transformation comes in different forms. It comes in different shapes and sizes. Some transformations are fairly limited in impact and scope, while other transformations are life-changing. They put your life on a completely different track. In Islam's oral tradition, there is a saying attributed to the Prophet Muhammad which points to this sort of sweeping transformation. Mutu qabla an tamutu. Die before you die. And as I explained last time, this is not the sort of natural death we all face with our last breath in this life. If I were to use a modern term, mutu qabla an tamutu refers to the death of the ego. And that's what I specified last time, death of the ego. This death will be the beginning of a new life here and now. The beginning of a new life on this earth. It leads to the birth of a whole new person. Inshallah, in the next couple of sermons, I will deal with this whole concept of ego. What does ego mean? How does the ego impact our thoughts and behavior? What do spiritual teachers such as Rumi mean by the death of ego? Let's begin with some background information on the word ego, the three-letter word ego, E-G-O. This word ego is actually quite popular. We use it a lot in our everyday conversations. For example, one might say, "Oh, my boss has a huge ego." Or someone else might say, "Such and such is a boost to my ego." Another person might say, "Oh, I just had an ego tripping. I was just ego tripping." For those of you who don't know what ego tripping means, with young kids, young folks use a lot these days, it essentially means that I did something, I did X, because it makes me feel important. It shows others how important I am. So anyhow, we toss around the word ego quite a bit. The word ego is actually a Latin word. It's not an English word. Ego is the Latin word for I in the English language. I don't know whether you know it or not, but it was the famous psychologist Sigmund Freud that popularized the term ego. He is credited with popularizing the term ego. Freud was German, so he wrote his works in the German language, and he used a German term, das Ich, which literally means the I. English translators, those who translated Freud's work from German to English, chose the word ego for das Ich. That's how, you know, this word became so popular in the modern West. But again, the word ego is not English, it's Latin in origin. Now, derivatives of ego is widely in circulation these days. Egoism, egotism, egocentric, egotistic, and a lot more. The critical point is this. The three-letter word ego means different things to different writers. There is no standard definition for ego. Each writer, each school of thought loads a particular meaning onto this word. And as such, ego may have positive connotations for a writer, while it may have negative connotations for other writers. And that's what makes the term ego so confusing. So just remember, there are many different definitions for ego. Now, in spiritual and religious literature, ego has a distinctive meaning. And that's the meaning that I have in mind today when I talked about ego. The meaning that ego has in spiritual and religious literature, what ego means to religious and spiritual folks. Here I'm not talking about what ego means in psychology. I'm not talking about what ego means to the likes of Freud. I'm talking about what ego means to the likes of Rumi. Now, at a high level, in spiritual literature, ego conveys two different ideas. In spiritual literature, ego has two different notions. These two ideas and notions are actually quite connected. But for analytical purposes, I will separate them out, so hopefully it would make it easier to grasp the range of meanings that ego has in spiritual literature. So now, what are those two ideas, two meanings conveyed by the word ego in spiritual literature? The first one, false perception. Ego sometimes means false perception. That's when a person confuses himself with things. Confuses himself with stuff, confuses himself with affairs that are external to him. So here, the ego is essentially a set of false beliefs about who I am. So that's the first meaning of ego. The second meaning actually has to do with a nasty personality trait. Ego here encapsulates a nasty personality trait. What is that? Being selfish. Being conceited and arrogant. That's what we mean when we say that person has a huge ego. Whenever we refer to a huge ego these days, we are talking about a person who has a supersized ego. Now, all spiritual teachers tell us that ego, in both senses, both meanings, is a major obstacle to moral and character development. All spiritual teachers tell us that ego is a serious impediment to spiritual development. Ego is a barrier to God realization. It's a barrier to getting closer to God. The ego must be overcome. That's what Rumi teaches, what Buddhism, what Hinduism, and other spiritual traditions teach. the ego must be overcome in both senses, both meanings that I just mentioned. And that's why in spiritual literature, the ego always has negative connotation. It's a bad thing to have. Today, I will focus on the first notion of ego, false self-perception. That's what I'm going to focus on today. And as usual, I will bring in my mentor Rumi for help. Next time, inshallah, I will discuss the second meaning of ego, that negative personality trait. So let's delve deeper into what false self-perception means. Every single one of us has an ego. There is nobody out there who can claim that I have no ego. So we all have ego. But ego is not a body organ such as lungs, hands, feet, eyes, so on and so forth. Ego is essentially an idea. Ego is essentially an idea that we hold in our heads about who and what we are. That's our ego. The idea that each one of us have about who we are. The trouble is this. We typically labor under a mistaken impression of who we truly are. We often confuse who we are with things that we possess, things that are external to us. We confuse who we are with what we have achieved. And in the process, we form a perception about who we are that is false and illusory. It's an illusion. Or better yet, it's a delusion. So ego refers to an illusory self-perception. Now, the idea we construct in our head about who we are, our ego, is not innocent. It greatly influences our thoughts, our motives, our emotions, and behavior. Our ego becomes a lens through which we see and experience the world around us. And that's the troubling aspect of ego as false self-perception. It becomes a lens through which we see and communicate with the world around us. Who am I? Who am I? We all have an answer to this question. You have it, I have it. We all have an answer to this question. Who am I? However, a few, very few of us ever deliberate about this question. Very few of us deliberate and then piece together a mental image of our self. The vast majority of us answer the question, who am I, subconsciously. And that's the root cause of the problem that many of us have, that we rarely sit down and really think about who we really are. Let me give you some examples of false self-perception. Some concrete examples of false self-perception. Who am I? I am what I have. In other words, my possessions define me. My car, my house, my financial wealth, they define me. In today's materialistic society, we acquire an identity by acquiring things. Our consumption describes who we are. Sounds familiar to you? It should, because that's the hidden message marketing folks send you in the ads you see every day in mass media. From early childhood, the materialistic culture conditions us to see ourselves and others in this light. You are what you possess. You are what you consume. Another example. Who am I? I am what I do. My achievements define me. My college degree, my job, my occupation, they define me. And by the way, that's why you and I, when we go to parties, one of the first questions that we tend to exchange with a new acquaintance is, what do you do? In the US and Canada, and for that matter, I believe in all Anglo-Saxon majority nations, a popular last name is Smith, as in blacksmith, silversmith, locksmith, gunsmith. These names that I just mentioned date back as far as the Middle Ages, a time when a person's job was such a defining characteristic. The person's job became their literal identity. The same holds true in Iran, Russia, Eastern Europe, and elsewhere. A lot of last names around the world are actually occupations. Next example. Who am I? I am my body. The shape of my body, my weight, my age, my physical attractiveness defines me. And that's why we spend billions of dollars every year to look more appealing. Cosmetic surgery is a $60 billion industry in the US, and that's all because modern folks tend to define themselves as their body. That's their perception of who they are. I am my body. If you want to know how far off course we are, just contrast the modern fixation with body with what Confucius and Buddha taught, with what Muhammad, Jesus, Moses, and Rumi taught. All of these great spiritual teachers taught us that we humans are an expression of God on earth. We are an expression of God because we carry the spirit of God. So in all spiritual traditions, Judaism, Islam, Christianity, Buddhism, man is essentially spirit, not body. So humans should beautify their spirit, not just their bodies. The next example. Who am I? I am what others think of me. My reputation defines me. What is reputation? Approval of others. Approval of others, which is a huge toll on the soul of young people in the modern West. It takes a huge toll on my daughter, my son, and your kids. Approval of others. The social media has made this problem far worse. You know how? By having a little button under every picture, every text that says like. You press that button and you approve what that other person has said or shown to you. More than ever before, we modern folks are obsessed with what others think of us. There is a mental health condition called social anxiety disorder. Do you know what that is? Look it up. Social anxiety disorder. Essentially, this disorder involves excessive fear of being judged by others. Excessive fear of being negatively evaluated and disapproved by others, being rejected by others. Lao Tzu, the ancient Chinese philosopher, said, "Care about people's approval and you will be their prisoner." Care about people's approval and you will be their prisoner. That is so true. In fact, all the other ego beliefs that I just mentioned, I am what I possess, I am what I do, I am my body, all of these false ego beliefs create a prison for us. Is it fun to be a prisoner? Are you ever going to be joyful, blissful in a prison? Heck no. That's the source of our misery in the modern world. These false ego beliefs that we have. Now, enough for an abstract discussion about ego. Let's get a little bit more practical, a little bit more tangible. Let's bring in Rumi, a giant figure in human spirituality. Rumi had to struggle with his ego, and that's what I want to dedicate the rest of my sermon to, Rumi's struggle with his ego, to make this whole discussion a little bit more personable. Before he met his mentor and a spiritual master, Shamse Tabrizi, Rumi suffered from a false sense of personal identity. Rumi was utterly confused about who he truly was. It was Shams who made Rumi aware of his most fundamental problem. Years after his decisive encounter with Shams, Rumi actually reflected on the 2.5 years he had spent with Shams. We are very lucky, you know why? Because in several places in Masnavi and Divan, Rumi's poetic masterpieces, Rumi lets us in to get a glimpse at his transformation. He lets us in to get a glimpse at the what, why, and how of his transformative experience when he met Shams. There is one poem in Divan where Rumi describes a dialogue between Shams and him. This poem is so famous that I'm sure some of you may have it memorized. Now, since we are short on time, I will read to you just parts of this fantastic poem, first in the original language Farsi, and then I will translate it into English with some commentary, because we don't have that much time. Now, the critical thing, and this is how I invite you to read this poem on your own. Each verse of this poem has two parts. The first part, it is Shams, the mentor, who is talking. The second part of the verse is actually Rumi responding to Shams. So here we go. These are the opening verses of the poem. مرده بودم زنده شدم گریه بودم خنده شدم دولت عشق آمد و من دولت پاینده شدم دیده سیر است مرا جان دلیر است مرا زهره شیر است مرا زهره تابنده شدم I was dead. I became alive. I was weeping. I became laughter. The fortune of love came, meaning Shams, Shamsuddin Tabrizi. The fortune of love came, and I became everlasting fortune. My eye is now satiated. My soul is bold. I have the guts of a lion. I have become the shining Venus. This is how buoyant, how joyful Rumi became after his transformative encounter with Shams. مرده بودم، زنده شدم، گریه بودم، خنده شدم، دولت عشق آمد و من دولت پاینده شدم. Rumi says, I was dead, I became alive. Sounds familiar? It should. Mutu qabla an tamutu. Die before you die. That's what the Prophet Muhammad preached, and that's what Rumi did. Die before you die. Rumi died and then rose up again, this time in a fuller and happier state. Now, guess what? Rumi had to pay a huge price for this transformation. A huge price. Rumi had to sacrifice a lot. In the following verses, Rumi tells us about his sacrifices. Now, in each verse that I'm going to read to you, he said refers to Shams. Again, that's the first part of the verse, Shams talking. گفت که دیوانه نئی لایق این خانه نئی رفتم دیوانه شدم سلسله بندنده شدم گفت که تو کشته نئی در طرب آغشته نئی پیش رخ زنده کنش کشته و افکنده شدم گفت که تو زیرککی مست خیالی و شکی گول شدم هول شدم و از همه برکنده شدم He said, again meaning Shams, He said, You are not insane. You don't deserve to be in this house. I went and became insane, crazy, and in chain. He said, You are not intoxicated, go, for you do not belong here. I went and became intoxicated, overflowing with joy. He said, You are not slain, you are not drenched in bliss. Before his life-giving face, I became slain and cast down. Did you notice what just Rumi said? Isis sends its followers to die in their own blood. They are slain in their blood. Shams asked Rumi to get slain, not in blood, but get drenched in bliss. That's the difference. Now here we're talking about two different versions of Islam. Shams invited Rumi to a gamble. What do we do when we gamble? In a gamble, we risk losing it all. We risk losing everything we have. Shams invited Rumi to lose all the things that he had piled up around himself. Shams asked Rumi to get out of the cocoon that he had built for himself. Shams told Rumi, Hey, this cocoon that you have built for yourself is a trap for you. Break it. Get out of it. And then you will get amazing prizes. What were the prizes that Shams just promised to Rumi? Love, intoxication, joy, bliss. The cocoon was Rumi's ego. The cocoon was Rumi's ego. And the fabric of that cocoon was Rumi's attachments, things that Rumi associated with, he identified with, things that defined Rumi. Again, we are lucky that in this poem, Rumi lists a few of his attachments that Shams asked Rumi to get rid of. Here is one of them. گفت که تو شمع شدی قبله این جمع شدی جمع نیم شمع نیم دود پراکنده شدم. He said, you have become a candle, the qibla of this assembly. I am not of assembly. I am not a candle. I have become the dispersed smoke. Shams told Rumi, you cannot receive the light of God because you see yourself as a light source to others. Isn't that amazing? You cannot receive the light of God as long as you see yourself as a light source for others. In other words, here Shams is making a distinction between reflecting the light of God like a mirror and thinking falsely that the light originates from you. Here, the other thing that Shams told Rumi is that, hey Rumi, you have become a compass for your followers, for the people around you. These folks around you, your followers, they find their direction by where you stand. You are God to them. People praise you. People adore you. You may not realize it, but you are effectively an idol for people. Both you and your followers are idol worshippers. Another attachment of Rumi. گفت که شیخی و سری پیش رو و راه بری شیخ نیم پیش نیم امر تو را بنده شدم. He said, you are the sheikh, the chief, the leader, the guide. Sheikh I am not. Guide, I am not. I will devote myself to your guidance. Shams said to Rumi, your followers, they put you on a pedestal. You are their beloved leader. You have become so famous, so popular. And you know what? Fame and popularity is now a prison for you. You are the prisoner of your followers. You are the prisoner of your followers. You must follow what your followers desire, or else they will abandon you. And what happens if your followers abandon you? Their abandonment will crush your ego, the very sense of who you are. Let me read to you one more attachment of Rumi. گفت که با بال و پری من پر و بالت ندهم در هوس بال و پرش بی پر و پرکنده شدم. He said, you already have your own wings and feathers. I will not give you feathers and wings. In a zeal for his feathers and wings, I shed my own feathers and wings. Shams said to Rumi, you already have wings. your academic achievement, your religious scholarship, your social standing, your political connections. These are your wings with which you fly. But you know what? With these wings, your soul cannot fly. Your soul cannot soar. If you want your soul to soar, you must shed your current wings. You must take on new wings. You must learn a new way to fly. You must learn to fly in a different way. And that's precisely what Rumi did. Rumi followed every advice of Shams. Rumi let go of his attachments. He left his past behind. He embraced the religion of love, which Shams preached. And that was a costly decision for Rumi. Rumi lost his fame and popularity among the religious mass in his town. Religious scholars scorned him. Jurists scorned him. Rumi lost all that he had worked so hard for. And then he found his true self. Once he abandoned his attachments, he found his true self. And when he found his true self, he blossomed. And that was the new life that Rumi received. Rumi had a son inside him, a son that was hidden behind his attachments. When he let go of his ego, when the veil of his attachments dropped, the sun inside him rose. That's how Rumi was born again. The death of his ego was the beginning of his eternal life. 800 years later, Rumi still lives in our imagination. Rumi still lives today in us as an inspiration. Well, we are over time and I have to stop right here. Inshallah, next time I will continue my talk on ego and discuss the second meaning of ego, which is a personality trait. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.